I am Jenny Nyman, and in early March, March 1st, I believe, it was the anniversary of the Peace Corps. This year was the 59th. We're coming up on the big 6-0 next year. And we thought it would be a kind of a fun show to recruit some Peace Corps alumni in the community. There are a fair amount of them knocking around out there. So in the studio today to talk about their experiences in the Peace Corps, we have Kaylin Simpson, who is an ESL teacher at KPC. Welcome.
Thank you.
And we have Ben Becker, a freelance writer in the community, former reporter at the Peninsula Clarion. Thanks for being here, Ben.
Thank you.
And David Wortonby, retired professor at KPC.
Good morning.
All right. Can we start with just introducing yourself? How long you've been in the community? What brought you to the Kenai Peninsula? Kaylin, let's start with you.
Well, I have, this is actually the second time I've been up here. Had a little bit of a break, but I came up for the first time back in 2013 and stayed for 4 years and then left to go take care of some personal business for 2 years and just came back in September.
Where are you from originally?
I'm originally from upstate New York.
Oh, okay. So winter is not unknown.
No.
Not an unknown phenomenon. Okay. Ben, how about you? How long have you been here and what brought you up?
I've been here since 2014. I came up to write for the Peninsula Clarion and was originally from Indiana, and I moved up here from Vermont.
And Dave, you've been here, low these many years.
I came up, actually started coming to Alaska in the 70s, but and fell in love with it. Finally moved here in 97 to take a job at Kenai Peninsula College and stayed there for a number of years, 18 years, and then finally retired. And so now I'm playing, and this is home. You couldn't get me out of here with a crowbar.
Well, we're not going to try to either. Since you're on the mic at the moment, Dave, why don't we start with you as far as your Peace Corps experience. So how old were you when you volunteered, and what made you decide to take that leap?
I was really interested in the Peace Corps when it was first developed. I remember when it was first developed, and I had a teacher who had been in the Peace Corps, and I talked with him and thought this was really a neat adventure. The day I turned 18, which was the minimum age, I put in my application and then went off to college for what turned out to be a few months, and I got an offer to go in the Peace Corps. Really didn't know what I was getting into, but I knew that I liked helping people, and it was something I'd been doing, volunteer work, etc. So I thought it would be a good fit. And as it turned out, I was 19 when I was living in Africa. I only had 1 year of college, and today you have to have a college education completed before you get in. But I was 19 when I was living in Africa and working in a vo-tech school.
Yeah, they, as you say, they require a little more, I think, world experience before they kick you out to parts unknown.
At that time, they were looking for skills. I had a skill set that I knew a lot about, metalworking and building and stuff like that. And so that's what they needed when they had people who had construction backgrounds and so on, who maybe had no college education at the time. Again, at that time, the thrust was to bring in people who could do certain jobs in the community.
Well, and the Peace Corps began in, 61, I think.
I think that's about right.
So it wasn't all that old when you got into it. So, I mean, when I was going to school, you just heard about it in the ether. It was AmeriCorps and Peace Corps, which is something that you knew about from being in high school. But where did you even hear about it from? Was it something that people just knew about, or did you know someone who had done it before?
Well, I had heard about it when it was first developed by John F. Kennedy, and then I met a person who had been in there, and a good friend of mine and I both were very interested in it, and he was 2 years older than I was, and so he applied and got in. So he was overseas while I was in training, and then as I went overseas, he was coming home. So that's kind of how I got started and heard about it. But again, it was a little, we heard more about it, and going to do rural community development or whatever it was sounded very interesting.
Was it the service aspect then, or did the travel part, see parts of the world, did that factor into it at all for you?
I don't think it, I don't think that did. I think I was too naive to have had that as an ulterior motive. But it was fascinating to think about going to Africa or going someplace that you'd never been before, although, you know, I did like to travel.
Well, Ben, how about you? How did you come to join the Peace Corps? Where did you hear about it, and what led you to make that decision?
Well, I joined after I graduated college in 2010. I can't remember precisely where I heard about it. As you were saying, it was something that people were generally aware of. It was kind of in the public consciousness at that point. And
yeah, I don't know. I'd be interested to see what their marketing plan was over the years, because they've done a good job of just everybody knows, has heard about the Peace Corps. Even it's not something I remember ever seeking out information about, but I think any kid in high school or going to college has some basic functional knowledge of what the Peace Corps is. So they are good at that, however that master plan works.
Yeah, I had learned about it in high school, and it was something that I kind of vaguely planned to do. I can't say that it was my end goal of my college career, but I'd always considered it as something I might do. And when in my senior year of college, I started going to recruiting events and learning about how to apply, and so I went for it. And my motivation was, I had several different motivations. It's kind of hard to say I joined for X reason. I did have sort of vaguely romantic notions of travel and excitement and seeing the world and all that. The service aspect was a motivation for me as well. I wanted to not just travel, but do something meaningful while travel. I didn't want to be a tourist.
Right.
I wanted to get a more grounded view of what these places were like. Also, I was graduating in 2010 and the job market wasn't great.
Yeah, so. I hear you on that one. Good to have an option out there. Okay, and so when Dave went in, he was mentioning that he had some metalwork background, some construction background. What was the skill set that you were pitching?
English,
okay.
I was graduating with an English degree, and there was a big demand in several places in the world for people learning English as a second language. It's kind of a ticket to some higher paying professional jobs in a lot of the world, and in Mongolia, particularly where I ended up. I can't remember when the Mongolian government did this, but they had declared English an official second language at some point.
So they're definitely looking for folks that could teach.
They were definitely looking for people who would teach English, and foreign investment was coming into Mongolia at this point. There were a lot of mining interests and companies looking to do business in Mongolia, and they wanted Mongolian English speakers. So a big surge in demand around the time that I got into it.
Okay. Kaylin, how about you? What led you to join, and what was that process like for you?
I put in my application my senior year of college also, so I went straight out of college that summer after graduation. And for me, it was a little bit of the travel, but also the social work. I actually went to college to get a business degree, oddly enough, with aspirations of becoming a social worker. That was guidance from my high school guidance counselor, was to have something to fall back on. And
those guidance counselors, they might have to get that tattooed somewhere if you're going to be a high school guidance counselor. Tell all the students to have something to fall back on.
Yeah. And so, you know, I had gotten my business degree. I'd actually been a Rotary exchange student back in high school, my senior year of high school. And so I'd had some overseas experience, already spoke Spanish, and, you know, was looking for some additional international experience, but also to be able to get my foot in the door as far as social work was involved. And so I put in my application and ended up getting it accepted into the micro enterprise development program, so small business, so utilizing my business degree, but again in social work, to start up a savings and loan cooperative out in a rice farming community in the Dominican Republic. It was a wonderful experience and definitely got me the social work that I wanted to do, but also utilize that business degree and utilize my Spanish that I had picked up in high school.
Yeah, that's great. since you're on the microphone here, we'll just start with you in the next round. What was the training program like? Did you feel like you were pretty well prepared for what you ended up doing? How did you come to find out where you were going? Did you get much of a say in that?
Well, the Dominican Republic was actually my second offer. The first offer that I received from Peace Corps was to go to Botswana and work with the government there and live inside a government compound in Botswana. And I said, you know, that doesn't sound very Peace Corps to me. You know, that's not the commercials that I had seen growing up, you know, the toughest job you ever love with, mm-hmm. you know, some guy pulling a canoe out of the water. And, you know, they said, well, if you turn this one down, you might not get another offer. And I said, you know, I think I'll take my chances because that's not exactly what I was looking for. And, you know, sure enough, about a month later, they called me back and offered me the position in the Dominican Republic. And I think I was off, you know, traveling within, I think, about 3 weeks of receiving that offer.
Oh,
I
wow.
was
That's
headed down to
turnaround.
Miami, and then we all kind of met in Miami and then got evacuated for a hurricane. So we weren't even there. I think it was supposed to be 3 days that we were supposed to be there before all flying over to the Dominican Republic, and they quick threw us on planes before the hurricane hit and scooted us over to the DR. And we spent 3 months in training in Santo Domingo, or just outside Santo Domingo, living with host families and going daily to a training center there before they placed us all out in our communities, the assigned communities. So, you know, I think we had pretty good training, you know, may not have known everything that we needed to know going into it, but certainly knew how to get the information that we might be missing. We all had a project that we were assigned to as our primary project, but the first 3 months that you were in your actual community, you were supposed to get to know everybody, not really be working on your project yet, but really kind of getting settled into your community and building relationships and also finding out what other projects they might need assistance with that perhaps weren't on their application when they requested a Peace Corps volunteer.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, even though I went in to start up a savings and loan cooperative, I ended up teaching a lot of classes in water purification and HIV education and teaching in a one-room schoolhouse and working on other small business projects and working in the rice fields and with aqueducts and things like that. And part of our training was just to inform us of what was in the little library that we had mm-hmm. available to us there in the capital that was all kinds of writings about experiences other Peace Corps volunteers had in projects that they did in their communities and kind of how they got that off the ground and the ins and outs of how to make it happen. So even if you didn't know how to build a latrine, you could easily look that up.
Right.
And then go back and do it.
And what years were you?
I was there from 1995 to 1997.
So Google probably was not much of an option for you.
Google was not an option. No, in fact, I was laughing the other day because, you know, even email was just really starting to take hold. And one of the things they did probably about a year after we got there is that, you know, they excitedly announced to everybody that they had opened this email account that we could all share. And here was this computer. And if we wanted anybody to send us anything, that they could send it. And then they would leave us a note in our mailbox, you know, for when we came in once every 2 months or so to pick up our mail, saying that we had an email message, you know, and remember thinking, but I don't even know anybody who has an email, you know. So, yeah, Googling things was not an option. It was all paper.
Yeah, so if you had a question, you really had to old school figure that out.
Yep.
Wow. Okay. So, Ben, how about you? How long were you in training? What did that entail? Did you feel like you were pretty well prepared for what you ended up doing?
My training, I think, was kind of on a similar schedule to what Caitlin mentioned. The first 3 months that we were in country, I lived in a village of about 100 people.
In Mongolia, you mentioned.
Yes, okay. Yes, in Mongolia.
So you don't get much training in the U.S. It's kind of herd you together and send you out to the location and then, okay.
Yep, in the U.S. it was herding. Herding is the right word to describe it. We kind of all came together in a hotel in San Francisco, and then they flew us out to Mongolia. So as I mentioned, the first 3 months, I lived with a host family. There were, I think, about five other volunteers in the same village. And our training was very much like school. It took place in a school. This was during the summer, so the students were out of school.
Okay.
And there were two English teachers that we had, Mongolian English teachers. They they taught English at this school, and so they kind of switched roles for the summer and taught us Mongolian.
Oh, yeah, I was going to ask, because you're, you know, teaching English, but in order to interact, you're going to have to know some Mongolian, I'm sure.
Yep, so our days were kind of split. In the morning, we had Mongolian lessons in the classroom from these two Mongolian English teachers. In the afternoon, we usually had some kind of classroom preparation because we were all there to be English teachers. We were going to be assigned to schools in Mongolia and teach alongside Mongolian teachers.
So kind of teaching you how to teach then?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Did you get much instruction on, like, the culture, the economy of Mongolia, the, you know, what kind of larger situation you're going to be existing in?
Yeah, quite a lot about the culture.
Okay.
And mostly very practical things. We didn't get much of, like, a very high-level, top-down view of Mongolian history. And
just kind of how to conduct yourself day-to-day so you don't offend people.
Exactly.
And you can understand customs and, okay.
Yep, definitely focused on the practical aspects of getting around and learning the sort of big picture history stuff you did on your own. But just living in this village was kind of a practical immersion education itself. So that was very well designed that way. I lived with a host family.
And when you actually started teaching then, did you feel like you're pretty well prepared for that? Or did you feel kind of a little at sea to start with?
Definitely a little SE. It's hard to learn a language in 3 months.
I can't even
imagine. And learning all the other things you're learning outside of it is pretty intense. But the immersion aspect definitely helps a lot with that. So I felt like I had kind of a basic ability to interact with people when I went into it. But it was very hard to prepare for anything, really, because the different schools were so different.
Oh, okay.
In all the different locations throughout Mongolia.
So what kind of school were you in? Like, what age range were you teaching?
I taught the entire range of school kids, I think. I think my youngest class, I taught a few fourth grade classes, and then all the way up to high school seniors.
And what years were you over there?
2010 to 2012.
Okay, and did you, I mean, internet was a thing at that point, but I don't know if it was much of a thing in rural Mongolia. So did you have much of that as a resource?
Yeah, there was an internet cafe.
Oh, okay.
that I went to about once a week.
Okay.
And I had a laptop as well. I didn't have an internet connection on it, but I could compose emails and write on it. I could write a bunch of text documents and then go to the internet cafe and send them.
Okay.
Viruses were very much a hazard.
Oh.
A lot of the computers they had there were really old Windows machines that were online in these internet cafes, and they were really prone to picking up viruses. So that was my laptop crashed once or twice because of that. And
I'm sure you had to get all the shots before you were able to go, but there probably weren't, you know, internet browser inoculations at that point.
But yeah, I taught English at a provincial school. It was in the provincial capital of Omnigovaimag, which is a state in the south of Mongolia. It's in the Gobi Desert. And it was a town of about 15,000 people. It was the provincial capital. And there were four schools. I was at school number four, the newest one. In some ways, it was kind of a regular teaching experience. I had classes I had to plan for and teach each day. There were three Mongolian English teachers that I worked with to sort of co-plan and co-teach. For various reasons, I was on my own. I mean, the classroom, it's very hard to plan things in Mongolia. Kind of one of the defining features of life is instability and contingency and things going wrong. And
oh, okay.
Doors being locked and people not being where they're supposed to be and the power going out and that sort of thing.
Not like the school settings here where...
Oh, yeah,
where
yeah.
11:54, the bell rings and you have 3 minutes to transfer to the next. Okay. All right. But, Well, Dave, let's move on to you. And I don't mean to keep referring to you as our back in the day person, but you were in one of the early Peace Corps rounds there. So I'm curious if after listening to these two, if you notice any differences about your training experience and your, you know, how things operated in your posting.
And my experience was, and back in the 60s, I was overseas in 1964 to 66. The offer that I received was to, actually I got two offers in the same packet from the Peace Corps. One was to teach English in Kenya, and the other was to be doing rural community development in Senegal. And
had you been hoping to end up in Africa, or?
Well, yeah, I had, because okay. my friend, my very good friend that, you know, he and I wanted to join together, but he was, you know, he could apply and got in before I could even apply. He was in Gabon, and so, you know, it would have been nice to have gone there, but, you know, going to Africa sounded like a great place to go.
Okay.
I realized I didn't know that much about English. I wasn't very good at conjugating verbs and so on. And consequently, I said rural community development is something that I do know something about and that I think I'm better versed there. So that's the one I chose. And it turned out that our training was 3 months long. We went to Southern Illinois University and spent a lot of time at the Vocational Technical Institute.
Oh, so you did training in the U.S. then?
We did three months of training in the U.S., and much of it was intensive in terms of, for example, it was interesting that while I knew how to weld at that time, they took a number of us into a welding program and taught us the fine skills of and even more about welding. And, you know, doing finer things and different things than what we knew how to do. Taught us about additional materials or information about forging and foundry work, which I had experience with already. And then construction type things, because some of the folks were going to end up doing construction or possibly doing construction. We also did language training virtually every single day. We had probably 2 hours in the morning and 2 hours in the afternoon of language training. At that time, again, this is shortly after they invented the wheel, the Congress mandated that Peace Corps volunteers had to take a course in American history. So, of course, we had to do a course in American history. That was part
interesting.
Of the training.
Do you know what the thinking was behind that?
Well, I think they figured that if they were going to send people overseas that to work in other countries, that they should at least know what their country really was doing and how they did things and what the politics were and how the government worked. And quite frankly, you know, it was, I think, beneficial. But we had extensive training of various kinds, including, of course, French. But then we also had training in Wolof, which is the predominant language in Senegal. A lot about culture, a lot about the history of Africa, because, you know, at that time, countries were just gaining their independence. I mean, you know, if you look at places like, Gambia became an independent country, no longer a colony, while I was living in Senegal, and I went to that to their celebration. So, you know, the countries were just getting independent, so it was a lot of transition going on in Africa at that time. So that training was quite different. Then we went overseas, and we did some kind of in-country training in the sense that they brought in speakers. We now had to really use our French and Wolof and whatever language in that, you know, communicate the best we could.
Mm-hmm.
And then we were chosen to go to various positions that they had. As it turned out, they needed somebody to teach metalworking in a United Nations Vo-Tech school, and that's was kind of my sweet spot. And so that's where I ended up. And
so you didn't know specifically what you're going to end up doing until you got over there.
Okay. We had worked in our training. We had worked on drilling wells and digging wells. We had worked on construction and a variety of things. So, we didn't know what we were going to do.
So you got kind of a whole extra VOTEC education just from joining the Peace Corps then.
I did.
Well, hey.
I really did, and that was something of great interest to me anyhow.
Yeah, okay. And then when you did get overseas, did you, our other two folks here were with host families. What was your housing situation like?
I would say, by comparison, we were just thrown to the wolves. I basically was assigned to go to this VOTEC school in Kaffrine. There was already a Peace Corps volunteer there working in the wood shop. Teaching in the wood shop, and I was coming in to teach in the metal shop. And one of the other instructors came and picked me up and took me to Kaffrine, and they had a house for us to live in. If you wanted to go buy food at the markets, you had to speak French, so it was speak French or starve.
Right.
And Wolof. We had very rudimentary things, like we had a kerosene refrigerator that worked somewhat. We had electricity maybe 2 hours a day. So, it was kind of crude. We didn't, computers, no.
Well, in the 60s, I wasn't going to ask you that one.
There wasn't anything like that. internet and so on didn't exist. We wrote lots of letters and so on and whatnot.
And as far as, so resources, when you had questions or ran into problems, did you have a lot of that, or you kind of felt on your own to figure it out?
One of the things that they did was they, for the most part, put two or three Peace Corps volunteers in the same town, often housing them together so that they could communicate. There was a gal that came into the town who was setting up a social center where she was going to be teaching sewing and health and so on. And the VOTEC school was very, very close, and so there were two of us in the VOTEC school, and she had a home by herself, and then we had a home together, and we could help each other. So, for example, when a sewing machine broke in her social center, I could go fix it, or if we needed something, I could go fix it or build something for them. And if I had a shirt that had a button that came off, she could put the button back on. Although, you learn to do those things yourselves as well.
I'm sure. Okay. Yeah, that's interesting how that has changed over the years.
We did
then.
Not have host families. There was a telephone in, there were two or three telephones in town, and that was it. So communication was kind of by sending a letter or go, if it was an emergency, go to the telephone and get permission to use it and so on.
Okay. Well, we, of course, have technology in this day and age, right. So I'm going to push some magical buttons here and play our break music. We're coming up on the bottom of the hour, so we're going to take a couple-minute break, refresh our coffee and whatnot. This is the Kenai Conversation on KDLL 91.9 FM. Please stay tuned. We're having a great conversation about the Peace Corps and how that experience has been for some of our local folks. So we will be right back. This is the Kenai Conversation on KDLL 91.9 FM, Kenai Soldotna. I'm Jenny Nyman, and we're talking about the Peace Corps today. Peace Corps anniversary, March 1st, and we are celebrating that by having some local folks in the studio today who participated in the Peace Corps. We've got Kaylin Simpson, Ben Betker, and David Whartonby. And we just got done talking about where folks went and what they did and how they joined the Peace Corps. Ben, we haven't started with you yet. What kind of maybe culture shock did you experience? What did you come away with or learn that you hadn't quite had your head wrapped around when you were still in the U.S.?
Food was one very big thing. Mongolians eat mostly meat. It's not very seasoned. So I ate a lot of unseasoned mutton while I was there, and that was interesting.
Had you been prepared for that? Did somebody mention to you what your diet was going to consist of before? Okay.
Yep. They mentioned that, and I got used to it and learned to enjoy Mongolian food. Definitely the lack of variety was something that they had to get used to. Whenever Peace Corps volunteers got together, food was always kind of the major
topic
of discussion. That was kind of the center of the ongoing conversation between all the volunteers.
And how did that work for you? Did you cook for yourself? Were you given a stipend to go grocery shopping? Did you have any assistance with that kind of thing?
I had a stipend. Okay. They gave us a stipend and we would go to the market and buy food.
What was the market experience like?
There were grocery stores, but they all had about the same collection of about a dozen Chinese made things. But the market was where I did most of my shopping. There was an open air market. There were meat shops and vegetable shops.
Okay.
Those were most of my shopping took place. And again, a lot of it was mutton, horse meat, camel meat. I ate a lot of camel.
And how was camel?
Really, really tough and chewy. But
and had you cooked for yourself much before?
Or not a whole lot.
Okay,
no.
So the college kid tower of pizza boxes kind of thing.
Very much that.
So you started at a host family for your training for your first 3 months. What was your living situation after that?
I lived in a yurt, or a ger is the Mongolian term. Yurt's the Turkish word. The yurt was in a compound, as most yurts are. The way families live together is they have these sort of fenced compounds. They call them hasha. That means literally corral. It's a corral for your family, I guess. They have a collection of like four or five yurts where the extended family lives. There's kind of like one that's for the grandparents, and then the children with their children all have their own little yurts. And so I lived with one of the teachers in my school. I lived in her hasha. I had my own yurt, which is an unusual thing.
No roommates.
Yeah. A single person living alone is a very unusual thing in Mongolia. People kind of pitied me for it. So I had people coming over all the time to help me cook and wash my dishes. And there were children running in and out. And it was kind of a regular show. When I shaved, all the children would come and watch that.
Because that was really
strange and interesting for them.
Of course, Ben, you, I'm sure, get tired of hearing this. But how tall are you?
6'8".
Okay, so you probably were a bit of a interesting sight in the community, I would imagine.
Yes, yeah.
What was that like? Were people coming up to you and kind of, aren't from around here, are you?
Yeah, constantly.
Okay.
Yeah, whenever I would be in some public place and I'd feel a tap on my shoulder, I would know that it was a Mongolian standing next to me and measuring themselves.
What is the average height in Mongolia, about like shoulder on you?
That. But it was something you got used to.
Did you run into any interesting preconceived notions that the Mongolians had of Americans?
Oh, all the time. They very much liked the sort of cowboy image. They wanted Americans to be cowboys.
It's always kind of interesting in the world what has been exported of American culture, whether it's fast food or some TV related thing or.
Yep. I think one of the reasons that the sort of cowboy archetype was sort of popular is because it, you know, was close to the Mongolian herding life.
Oh, that makes sense. And, okay. You had to break that image and tell them you'd never ridden a horse before and had no spurs and couldn't do a lasso and all of that.
Mm-hmm. And they really liked the businessman archetype was another thing, like some sort of hasha entrepreneurial. That sort of thing. I remember once I was at school, and I guess you would call him the groundskeeper of the school. He came up to me and gave me a pair of aviator sunglasses and put them on and said, "There, now you look like an American." So they were the whole sort of cowboy action hero, Tom Cruise, Clint Eastwood image that's what Americans looked like.
Well, Caitlin, how about you? How was the cultural immersion process like for you?
A shock, which was probably good. It was probably best to have the rug kind of yanked out from under us all at once rather than losing things kind of little by little. But yeah, we were dropped off with our host families, and then everybody needed to walk into the training center on a daily basis. But yeah, you're suddenly in this very rustic home, you know, a lot of times just tin cans that have been flattened out, you know, the larger tin cans that have been flattened out and then used to build walls and ceilings. And you've got chickens, you know, roosting on the the roof that literally is maybe an inch off of your head and it's 120 degrees and you burn your head every time you walk into the house because it's just so hot, radiating that heat down through in the Caribbean. And, you know, no electric in my host family's house. And we did have some running water. It wasn't consistent, but we did have some running water in the house. And yeah, the food was definitely different. I mean, we mainly had rice, beans, yuca, plantains, and then whatever fruit we could come up with. And if you would go into the Capitol, you know, there were a lot more things because, of course, the embassy was in the Capitol and there was a lot of tourism in the Dominican Republic. So if you got into the Capitol, you could find quite a bit in the grocery stores. The problem was we couldn't afford it, you know, because we were all living on this stipend, which was set up to have us live basically at the same economic level as the communities that we resided in.
Oh, right.
So, you know, within the Dominican Republic, I think there was four different pay scales, and I was in the lowest of those pay scales since I lived in a rice farming community. And, you know, there was a little bit of extra money that was put in there for us to be able to purchase stamps and, you know, make a trip into the Capitol to pick up our mail and our medicines. But, you know, so we'd go into the Capitol and then we couldn't afford anything that we would see, which was very often disappointing. But yeah, it was a shock. But like I said, I think it was good that we kind of lost everything all at once instead of having it taken away little by little.
Right.
And it was just, you know, okay, adjust.
What kind of maybe stereotypes or misperceptions did you run into?
Everybody thought all Americans were from New York.
Oh, really?
Yeah, you know, specifically New York City. Because, of course, you know, as people left the Dominican Republic and immigrated, they all went to New York. And so they wouldn't even say the United States. They called the United States New York.
Hmm.
So, you know, I guess that was one, probably the biggest misconception, so, is that they assumed everybody lived in the big city.
And was there a lot of curiosity or interest in you when people saw you out and about wandering around, or did you just kind of melt into the community?
No, there was definitely, I stuck out. So for most of the people, I think I was probably the first Caucasian person they had met. And so, yeah, I stuck out like a sore thumb with my blue eyes, at the time, much blonder hair, while I was there. But eventually, you know, after, cause I was there a little bit over 2 years and, eventually that just kind of went away and everybody just became used to the fact that I was there. But, yeah, initially, yeah.
Okay. And Dave, how about you? What was your cultural experience like? Sounds like maybe not quite as much support going into it. So what kind of misconceptions did you run into? Or what were some of the more surprising things for you?
I think the thing that for me, of course, remember, I was 19.
So you didn't know anything about anything at that point, really.
I was dumb as a stone. And I realized how poor these people in the community were. You know, I remember being struck by seeing a person who was carrying in a small little rag. They had taken that square of material and put every single thing that they owned in that and were carrying it down the street. And that's literally all they had, which, you know, I realized how wealthy we were here in this country, and while I thought I had come from poor stock, you know, we were very wealthy in terms of, you know, we had a roof over our head and so on. So I think that was a big culture shock to me, was to see that poverty, and of course, also to see things that they, like, for example, having electricity. I was one of the few houses in town that had electricity, but we only had it for a couple hours a day. We had running water. I think there were 10 houses in the town that had running water, and mine was one of them. most of the people came to get water at a public fountain, so to speak, and they would fill up, you know, the ladies would fill up the water and carry it off to their, wherever they lived, maybe 2, 3, 4 miles away. And so that was, you know, kind of a, you know, that was quite a cultural difference. And to see that, you know, most people didn't have bicycles. Nobody had cars, you know. So that, again, kind of a cultural shock there. And I think relating to, as I said before, kind of the poverty level. Now, in terms of who the people were and what they wanted, and so, you know, they were just like us, you know, the parents wanted their kids to grow up and get a good job and go to school and so on. And they, you know, had this great demand and desire for education, just like we did and just like anybody else. So, you know, there were similarities that we were very much like, and then some areas in terms of, you know, what we, materialistically, what did we have? Now, I thought Kaylin's comment about how she was paid, we received a stipend too, and the stipend was based on, so you would have the same amount of money that somebody who is doing your job, who is a host country national. So, you know, my stipend was about $125 a month, and that had to take care of paying for rent and for anything and everything that you did.
Right.
Buying food, buying clothes, you know, if you needed batteries for your flashlight, you know, needed kerosene to put in your lantern that we used it for light at night, you know, that came out of that. So we weren't impoverished, so to speak, but, you know, we were limited in terms of what we could get. In terms of, you asked about food and food differences. This was a former French colony, so there was a lot of that colonial influence in terms of what was available in terms of food. I was very fortunate. My mother was a home ec teacher, so she taught all our kids how to cook. And you know, I had no problem going to the abattoir and pointing out a piece of meat and saying, you know, I want a kilo of that. And or going to the open air markets and buying whatever it was that I needed, fruits and vegetables. And they had the chaîne d'avion, which was the kind of like their version of a Cars and Safeway store, but think of them about the size of this room with very little in it, and you get what you could. But it wasn't expensive, you know, we could live off of what we got and so on.
Okay. Well, we're getting back up towards the top of the hour, so I think we've got time for one more question for all of you. I'm kind of curious, from your experience, what do you think that you gained from that? What do you think maybe you took into the rest of your lives that you found beneficial, whether it was, you know, Peace Corps looks great on a resume, or do you feel like you as a person changed or grew in a way that was helpful to you moving forward? Kaylin, let's start with you.
Yeah, several things. I think definitely it grew my creativity and my out-of-box thinking in terms of problem solving, you know, because I had to do a lot of out-of-box thinking. I only had what I had while I was there. And it also made me value a lot more the things that I have, and also be a little bit more conservative, I think, probably in my buying and spending and determining whether or not I really need something or not. I'm very minimalist in what I own in life. And I think that comes from that, from, you know, a lot of times carrying everything I owned with me every place that I went. And valuing relationships. You know, I call those couple of years my rocking chair days, you know, because we spent a lot of time as a community just sitting around in rocking chairs and talking in the dark, you know, because there was no electricity. And we just spent hours, you know, talking about what the community needed or things in our personal lives and, you know, making plans for how we were going to deal with whatever would come up. and just really good conversations. I don't see that so much anymore. We all spend all our times on our little phones and social media and things yep. like that, but we don't sit around in rocking chairs for hours every day just talking.
And we're not as trained, I think, to look to others for assistance and support and information. We're kind of siloed, I think, again, because of the phones and the internet, which is a wonderful thing, but I think that's a lot of people's first instinct is to look for some outside source of how to deal with this. Whereas it sounds like you guys, if you had an issue or a problem, you had to work it out in the community with the resources and the people that you had available.
Exactly.
Okay. Well, Ben, how about you? What did you get from your Peace Corps experience that you feel like has been useful to you afterward?
Really, the whole experience left me with a lot, many more questions than answers. I don't know if I learned a lot so much as kind of became, I guess, usefully confused about things.
That's a good term.
It really shook up a lot of the things that I felt certain about and thought I knew about the world. And I guess in a way you could say that kind of prodded me into journalism,
that trying to kind of curiosity yeah. of open mind of wondering how things work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, as I said, I graduated with an English degree and taught English, but I didn't really have much of a solid course in mind, but when I returned, I was pretty set on getting into journalism. So that was one legacy of the Peace Corps experience for me. I became a much more patient person. Patience and tolerance, you can't really survive without them.
Right.
In Mongolia, when you don't know what's going to be in the store when you get there, and whether the lights will be on tonight and that sort of thing. I learned that it helps to approach things with flexible expectations, and patience, tolerance, and persistence was traits I picked up.
Being able to roll with it, mm-hmm. I think, is a good, useful skill for elsewhere in life. All right, Dave, how about you? What did you get out of your experience that you found helpful?
I think that, quite frankly, the Peace Corps experience is the best thing I've ever done.
Not a paid spokesman, but...
No, I really do believe it was... I remember I was overseas when I was 19. I feel like I grew up overseas. And when I came back to the States and started going to college and so on, or going back to school, and of course I never left school then, but I had this measuring stick of something else, of a different culture. I think it taught me so much about other ideas that while I have an idea and I think it works this way, somebody else may have a different idea. And that understanding that there are different points of view was critical, and that's that I think that's one of the things I learned very importantly while I was overseas. Again, the experience was very good. It was something that did look good on resume, but I think the most important thing was what it did for me. It made put things in my head that I think made me a better person, someone who could see more what was going on in the world than going on around me and understand somebody else has a different view than I do.
Right. And you, it sounds like you got maybe a little more intensive actual skills training. And you didn't necessarily end up being a welder later in life, but did you find any of that stuff useful?
Well, yes. At the time, I really didn't want to go to college. I was more interested in becoming a machinist. And so, I then realized while I was overseas that I better go back and go to college, and I thought I wanted to be somewhere in the medical arena and become a biologist perhaps, but that's kind of where I ended up anyhow.
Oh, interesting. So it kind of that experience kind of changed your priorities or your trajectory.
It did. It kind of pointed me toward the medical arena, and
what was it about that experience that led you down that road, do you think?
I think seeing people suffering with varied diseases, the dispensary in town had three syringes, and they looked like corkscrews.
Oh.
They used them over and over and over again. I'll never forget that, seeing that type of thing. And, they had very, very poor medical care, and I thought I'd like to in some way try and improve that.
All right. Well, we are back up to the top of the hour, so we're going to have to leave it there. But Kaylin Simpson, Ben Betker, and David Wortenby, thank you so much for being here this morning and sharing your experiences. It's been fascinating. I got to learn about the Peace Corps, and I didn't have to learn how to eat camel or anything, so much better for me. All right, so this has been the Kenai Conversation on KDLL 91.9 FM, KenaiSoul.na. Thanks for tuning in.